Hi, and welcome to the Filmmaker Toolkit Podcast. I'm Chris O'Fault, Deputy Editor of Film and TV Craft here at IndieWire. Today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite films of the year, Sound of Metal, with the film's director, Darius Marder, and the star of the film, Riz Ahmed, who plays Ruben, a drummer who suddenly and unexpectedly goes deaf. Riz and Darius, I recently had a chance to interview Nicola Becker, who's the sound designer in this film, as you guys know, and he said something really interesting, and I wrote it down. I want to read it because I think it might be an interesting place for us to start. This is Nicola here. It's about our body, how we feel sound, and if we can find some connective world in common. It's not processing. It's about how the body receives vibrations from the outside. I tried to recreate this experience. I cannot ignore the historical vocabulary of sound and cinema, which has been created for 100 years. But what is interesting to me is to come back to real life, to come back to the experience of the real world. What is happening when you are deaf? What can you feel? Now, Darius, obviously here Nicola is talking about sound and a different type of subjectivity that the two of you were reaching for through sound in this film. And we'll have time to get into all that nitty gritty. But I'm wondering, you know, big picture, because I think it might be an important place to start here. What was the relationship that you were looking to build between the audience and Riz's character as he's going through these experiences, as he's experiencing the world around him in a completely new way? What was that relationship? Where were you trying to put the audience in relationship to what Riz was going through?
Yeah, and it is connected to what Nicola was talking about, which is that, you know, it's interesting, Riz, and it all boils down to the same thing, which is veracity and the truth of when we look upon truth and feel truth, what actually happens to us as human beings, because I think we recognize something fundamentally human when that happens. So, you know, a lot of people talk about your eyes, Riz, and what I'm struck with you and Ruben is that you filled Ruben with truth. And that was through a lot of work and building a foundation. That's what I wanted. That's what I was after. I was after someone who was willing to build this character from the ground up, just as Abraham and I did when we wrote it, but then build it so it was true for you. So that when we hit this set, we could set up a playground of reality, a playground of things that had real consequences, whether it was a real concert with a real audience, which we did in a club, without the kind of fakery that is usually found in films, or whether it was, you know, a real, you know, deaf community, at least a community of people that were part of the deaf culture, and where in order to communicate, you had to do it with ASL. There was no other way to do it. So the degree to which you learned it was the degree to which you were able to communicate. All those things that had real consequences and a sense of actual, that would take striving to attain, I think is what makes the journey so tragic. So for instance, the realer the sound is, the realer the music is, the more there is to lose when you lose it. And I think it's what Nicola is talking about. When we hear sound that's rooted in something true and real, we all have a collective human memory of our sounds. And so when we talked a lot about this in a very geeky way, but a lot of the film is reminding us about our own memory of sound on a very subtle level, which is to say, we lose it at moments in the film, and then we hear it again in almost in a hyper reality. So that the truer we could be to that, the more specific we could be to that specific bird or those cicadas or those insects, even in a three-dimensional landscape, because they were filmed with these, I mean, recorded with these multi-directional microphones, they would bring us all back to our collective memories and those things that we've lost. So in other words, the simple takeaway is the truer and more specific it is, the more it resonates as a human experience.
You know, and Riz, one thing as I'm rewatching the movie this week that really struck me, even before we talk about your character's journey into becoming deaf, it seems to me that a brilliant
screenwriting breakthrough for this story was for your character to be a drummer and to start off with this very visceral experience of drumming that I have to imagine was key for you to go on this journey as a character. No?
Yeah. I mean, learning the drums was a big part of stepping into this role. And that was for many reasons. One is obviously Ruben is a drummer. So as Darius said, he wanted to create this, he described it as a playground of consequences. I remember the first time we met, he said, "I want it all to be for real," essentially. You know, when you're playing drums on screen, I want you to be really playing the drums. I love music too much to fake it. And I said, I love that idea. I'm up for learning it. And we had the idea that it should be similar for American Sign Language, that should be able to improvise with the deaf actors on set. There was that technical aspect of needing to learn to play the drums because Ruben's a drummer. But there's also, I guess, the emotional dimension to learning to play the drums, in that, drumming is a very primal thing to do. And it's a primitive form of nonverbal communication, and also a way of really kind of expressing what's inside in a very visceral way, and actually kind of being forced to smash these drums up every day for many hours for many months, I think kind of brought Ruben out in ways that I hadn't expected. I think it opened me up physically. It forced me to become more of a nonverbal communicator. And so I think it really informed the performance and also me as a person going through that process of developing this new, this new skill set, this new way of communicating and connecting to my feelings, expressing my feelings.
Because one thing that's come up and when having the kind of geeky tech talks about this film is this idea that one feels sound with the body, and that's something that you're looking for. And I think, and Darius had just said something too, that the almost trying to tap into the audience's body of memory. And just reading the press notes for is one thing. It's like, obviously there's a learning the drums, but your body is this conduit. It's this thing that we're going to experience sound through. And it seems as if not just learning drums, but your body itself and getting that ready into a certain shape and kind of getting in touch with your body in a different way for this role, no?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that, we do listen with our bodies. The best kind of listening, the most holistic kind of listening, is with our bodies. It's not just about processing things in our heads and, thinking about a response. It's really absorbing the energy of someone else and holding space for the vibe that they're sending you as well. And, it was interesting filming this. We did some, I wanted to kind of dip my toe in the water of what it would be like to not be able to even, hear yourself. And so we took some hearing aids and flipped them into a white noise setting and put them in my ear canal, so that for certain scenes, particularly when Ruben's just experiencing hearing loss and I wanted to experience that as well, get a glimpse of it at least, I couldn't hear myself. And at that point, you are forced to listen with your body. You are sensitized in a different way. It does force you to kind of be more physically present. I was kind of, put in that position of being, of trying to listen more with my entire body. And I guess, speaking of American Sign Language as well, and thinking about that in the preparation process, that's also a kind of, a very physical way of communicating. And Jeremy Stone, my sign instructor, would often tell me that there's this trope in the deaf community that hearing people are emotionally repressed because they hide behind words. Whereas when you express yourself in sign, you are forced to inhabit what you are saying and connect to it viscerally and physically in a different way. And I myself would find, I'd find myself getting emotional discussing things in American Sign Language that I could very easily pass off with a string of clever words. If I was just speaking in English. And so, I felt that learning American Sign Language really did open me up emotionally. And in many ways, the deaf community taught me the true meaning of the word communication, connected, embodied communication.
Before we move on from the drumming thing, I'm just, Darius, I'm wondering if you could talk about the very distinct way you wanted to start this movie and why that was important. And I imagine also putting an extra challenge on Riz, who's a musician in other regards, but just learning drums, you know, to have that very distinct experience with him playing drums to open this movie. Why was that important to ground the audience and how we started this?
Well, it was so important. Actually, it turned out to be outrageously important, because the truer that, what you don't realize, I was actually just looking at the script because I hadn't looked at it in a long time, and I was looking at the first line of it as it is now, and the first line is "he hears," the first two words is "he hears," and I was realizing, like, you know, we're in Ruben's experience from the first frame, we just don't know it yet. Mm-hmm. And there's such a direct correlation with the first image of that of the film and the last image. They're mirrors. And the veracity, the truth of that sound in the beginning of that performance and Ruben's world, and what you grasp from just the image that of Riz and as Ruben at that kid in the beginning, and it says everything about who he is then, and if you look back on and where he's about to go. And so the truer we feel, you know, that sound, which is harsh, you know, their music, which is obviously what it is intoxicating, but it's also, you know, it hurts a little bit, and it's meant to hurt. And that pain is essential, because we want to start to connect with the music. I always thought about it a little bit like, you know, lose a cutter, you know, and that music's supposed to cut a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's reminding us that we're alive.
You know, Riz was just talking about that, putting things in his ears so he could have the perspective of you know, what a deaf person to some degree experiences. You know, when we think about point of view, so often in movie making, we think visuals. We don't think sound. And I want to come back to what Riz was saying about what he experienced. But I'm wondering, it seems as if, I'm wondering if you could even talk about that idea of working with point of view from sound, and also then therefore different types of sound, that type of sound that Riz was just describing experiencing, you know, versus I don't know what the word is. I would say naturalistic world, but maybe that's an able-bodied thing to say. I don't know.
No, but I don't, you know.
Exactly. That's true. You're exactly right about that. It's from a hearing perspective, isn't it?
Yeah.
This concept of, I've been calling it POH, you know, mm-hmm. it's point of hearing. And mm-hmm. and it's very interesting, actually. This was such an audacious experiment, to tell you the truth. And, you know, a lot of people didn't understand it while I was trying to get this film made for many, 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 many years, that there was going to be this character of point of hearing. And part of that, there's a very, what I think is a pretty sophisticated language around that, which is to say, not only is it a commitment to point of hearing, but it's a commitment not to point of view. So, and to be specific about that, like, for instance, in the beginning of the movie, you see Ruben, you're in his world and his world of hearing, and then he's in the Airstream and he looks out the window, but we don't look out the window with him. And the reason we don't, from a camera and from an editorial standpoint, is that that isn't our point of view. We're actually focused on his auditory point of view. And that's a very committed language, I would say, up until the last scene, which is the only scene where we actually have a point of view. Mm-hmm. And that's because there is an arc toward that sensory experience. It's so much about the codependent relationship we have with hearing itself. Right. So so the language of perspective, and when I say codependent relationship, I mean, for most people who are hearing people, they say this is a horror story, right? This is something I can't imagine. But, you know, obviously for deaf people, it's not a horror story. Yeah. It's a way of life. And then what you come to find out is that maybe the horror story is the very thing we're living and was there all along. And was there before the hearing was gone. And the monster certainly was. So the perspective, the auditory perspective, the shifting in and out, it's like an empathy machine because we go inward and we're in a body. That was an audacious experiment, and it needed a full commitment. And, you know, I'm so happy that some people are feeling that, and, because it was intoxicating to imagine that cinematic language.
And Riz, you mentioned this. How much, when you were shooting, did you need to yourself have that auditory experience of the, I don't know what the device is that that was in your ears to a certain degree, or was that something it's like you could try it out, understand it, and then work without that device?
Yeah, it was that. I tried it out at the beginning just to understand it, just to kind of really tap into the emotion. You know, I'm never going to capture that. I'm never going to kind of experience fully what it is, mm-hmm. To go through that, you know, on a set, but I can tap into the emotional kind of, that initial feeling of shock and disorientation, which once I could kind of had accessed, I could kind of run with and kind of, you know, work without those hearing aids. Yeah.
Well, can I just jump in on that just a little bit? I think it was a little more specific than that. The hearing, they were custom made ear things that it emitted it could have a tinnitus or it could have a white noise, but you used them up until the point where you were in, where you became part of that community, so mm-hmm. that they were there when you were in a state of denial, and that was. That was you really committed to that, Riz, which was really impressive, even so much that between shots I couldn't communicate with Riz as a director. You know, we would write things down or find a way to communicate and staying in that modality, and then you didn't need them once you were a part of that community. It wasn't about that anymore, but then you needed them again in the third act. Because yeah. that became another chapter of a certain other kind of denial.
Yeah, it's a great point. I guess it's the moments in those sections in the film where his deafness is, or at least in his mind, defined by a kind of loss. That's when right. we had this kind of glaring white noise that cut you off from things. Right. But within the deaf community, where we were kind of communicating non-verbally, both on camera and off camera, you know, with all our deaf actors, it became irrelevant. Deafness was no longer about a loss. Deafness was an identity, a culture, a community. You know, it presented its own opportunities for connection. So it wasn't about lacking something anymore or being exactly. cut off from something anymore.
Yeah.
Thanks for reminding me of that. I'd forgotten how we were kind of yo-yoing between those two ways of experiencing deafness, just as Ruben does.
Because it reads, to be honest, with Riz in those first few scenes early in the film, a disorientation, that inability to connect, that I have to imagine was key to kind of like where he went before finding a little bit of a community, a little bit of a form of stillness in with Joe and all them.
Yeah, the chronology of it was such a gift for all of us, and I would imagine for Riz especially. Mm-hmm. But yeah. You know,
yeah, it's huge, hugely so. I mean, you know, there were a lot of kind of factors at play in making this film. You know, we didn't have a tremendous amount of time to film it. Darius was adamant that we shot it on film as well, which obviously, you know, creates a certain amount of limitations in terms of how many takes you can do. It starts to get very expensive. And then also we don't have much time to begin with. But those parameters were also kind of set up alongside other conditions that just made it such an immersive and authentic experience. You know, the fact that we did shoot chronologically was just so helpful. And so it just meant that we all went on that journey. You know, we all really did. And it kind of felt like an immersive filmmaking process in many ways. We were living that, you know, Olivia and I were going to band rehearsals and putting this, you know, this performance together for this real gig that we would do in front of a real audience in a real club. You know, we were shooting in order. And so we were kind of living through the journey of this relationship together. And I think that's part of what really helped us capture some moments that just felt really honest and almost more like an observational documentary at times.
Building off that, Riz, I'm very curious. The man who played Joe, is it Paul Ricey's? He's a conduit to community. He becomes a spiritual guide. But my sense, especially in this idea of shooting chronologically, that he possibly played a larger role for the film and for you in that same way of becoming part of the community and almost as a spiritual guide now.
Yeah, I mean, Paul is just an incredible human being, and his own biography overlaps incredibly, almost unbelievably, with Joe's in the film. Paul is someone who's culturally deaf. He's a child of deaf adults or a coda. And his first language is American Sign Language. That is his native tongue. That is his kind of native culture, so to speak. And, you know, he is also a war veteran like Joe, a Vietnam War veteran. He's also in an American Sign Language Black Sabbath tribute band. You know, so he kind of has all these traits that allowed him to connect to the character of Joe and bring that to life so authentically. And yeah, he was a kind of patriarch for us on set, you know, as kind of one of the elder actors on set, and as someone who was working within kind of the deaf community, both with regards to kind of music and musical performance, but then also within addiction circles, and had helped lead kind of recovery groups and AA groups within the deaf community. That stuff that he had done in his real life, and so he could bring that to bear. So again, it just kind of added this layer of authenticity and this sense that even though, you know, it's such a kind of intentionally crafted and shot and sound designed film, for us as the actors, Darius was really adamant to create an environment where we could immerse ourselves in a kind of reality that we were building together.
I imagine, Darius, having someone like that on set is incredibly valuable, not just from an authenticity standpoint, but and just that relationship that develops between Joe and Riz and the journey he's been on. I have to imagine one could imagine a phenomenal actor playing that role and doing a good job of it, but I have to imagine there's something that this brings to it, and it allows you to work in a certain way. No,
I can't express it strongly enough. I mean, watching Riz and Paul in those very specific scenes, I was crying so much it was embarrassing, because there was such a sense of palpable emotion there, so much at stake, so much real emotion at stake. And I think the thing to note about Paul, you know, I think we've seen in some movies where people find someone who's very close to the character that in their movie, and they might not even be such a great actor, but there's so much truth in them that you kind of you would prefer it to maybe a more polished actor. The thing that's extraordinary about Paul is that he brings all of these overlapping truths to the character of Joe, which is undeniable, whether it be war veteran or all these things and alcoholism. But he is an outrageous actor. And it was as if you had found this, you know, Robert Duvall or Pacino or De Niro. You know, he's an actor of outrageous talent who no one's seen, even though he's been striving for 30 years in Hollywood. So it had that, it's just important to note that it's like, he's not amazing because he's close to Joe. He's amazing because he's amazing.
You know, it's interesting because the arc of this film moves one towards, in a spiritual direction, but also towards stillness. And it feels as if that also, and that silence, and it seems as if almost, you know, you and I talked right after the premiere in TIFF, which was like, God, like 2 years ago now. But it was interesting. You had said something to me that stuck with me, which was that you didn't set out to make a spiritual film, but you kind of ended up making one, and it ended up kind of relating to some things from your childhood. And there's an element here, because things arc and Joe becomes this kind of, towards stillness, towards silence. Riz's performance becomes one of incredible, the physical transformation and the stillness that he finds at the end of this.
Yeah, I mean, I was raised Buddhist, and I don't think that's irrelevant, as it turns out. And you know, I think that so much of that practice is about acceptance and you know, samsara or hell is about denial, and that the film ultimately really is about that. And I think that I think it is surprising to me how much as during the writing process, and I think it was so important that I wrote it with my brother, because he kind of, together we allowed for all of that, you know. And I think what is exciting to me is when you can have a visceral, physical feeling of surrender versus an idea of it. That if we feel that in this movie, literally feel it rather than think it, I think that's what's so exciting to me. That you know, and that's unique to having a first person experience and a first person perspective, which is a grueling language, but it does have this kind of very rewarding aspect to it.
And Riz, I have to say the performance, one of the things that is amazing about this is the physicality of it on your part, because one feels that addiction kind of freneticness, and then where you end up on that bench at the end. Kudos to you, but I have to imagine almost in arcing that and thinking about that as an actor, I'm not saying you couldn't have done it, but I have to imagine the chronological nature of this had to have helped you in kind of arcing that physicality of your character, no?
Yeah, I guess it's the chronology, but the thing is, when you're arcing a character, it's not something that you kind of self-generate, you know, it's the way your character behaves from one context to another, from one point in the story to another, is very much kind of molded by your surroundings, the energy of the characters around you at that point in the story, the place and the space that you're in. So in a way, kind of, you know, shooting in, I think we were in Antwerp, which is, we were shooting for Paris, shooting there, shooting with Mathieu Almeric, shooting with a new kind of Olivia Cook who'd had her haircut and had a different energy and was singing in French, you know, all these things kind of have their effect. So at any given point, kind of where the character is at, I always think of like characters like a planet, you know, planets don't hold their orbit because of some kind of internal engine. A planet holds its orbit because of the gravitational pull of the bodies around it. And so really it was kind of down to the energy and the generosity and what the other actors around me are giving me at any given point that really help set the temperature for what, you know, I end up doing as Ruben, and particularly within the deaf community, you know, and particularly going to a new location like Antwerp, you know, these things, they kind of affect your body and affect, you know, the way that you kind of carry yourself. For sure.
And it's interesting though too, sorry about that, it was just so really interesting to think about actually, Riz, you know, the amount of intense fear and nervous frenetic energy that we started this thing with, because the concert was coming and there was just like this unbelievable pulse to what we were doing that was so much at stake. Can you imagine if like we were shooting that last and we had to shoot the end of the scene before that, you know, the ends, you know, it would have been
a different age. You're right. I don't mean to dismiss the idea that chronology is important. Absolutely.
No,
absolutely.
I love what you were saying about the planets and the orbits, because I witnessed that in you. And I think you're exactly right. But I also remember that, you know, to be able to shoot that last and know that you were walking away from the whole story and walking away from the character and it's over.
It is. It's in a way, it's kind of Ruben is saying goodbye to the old Ruben. And in a way, as an actor, it's very helpful because you can step in and say, you know, I, as Riz, am saying goodbye to Ruben, you know, that's the scene. The scene is we're both saying goodbye to Ruben. And so, yeah, it's tremendously helpful. And actually, you know, particularly the fact that Olivia and I were separated for, you know, the whole middle chunk of the shoot, that, you know, 2 weeks or whatever, meant that when we came back together, we really were really coming back together. And I'd lived this whole other life with this deaf community, you know, up in Massachusetts, and she, you know, things that happened in her life, and it was a kind of like slightly awkward kind of, you know, sniffing each other and saying, "Hey, hello, you again." And particularly, I think that the particularly helpful and particularly cruel thing that Darius did was start off pretty much right at the start of the shoot with the gig. So it was, it had a lot of that adrenaline, nervous energy in it. But in a way, once we got it out of the way, we could kind of exhale and actually carry the kind of buzz of having pulled that off forwards with us. So it was, it's like so much of what Darius did and how he put this film together, it was very audacious. And I think when you set up a high wire act, you know, you force people to focus their minds. You know, time and again, there was the option of saying, you could fake the drumming, or, we'll shoot it like this, or, we'll cast this actor and we'll get more money and we'll get more time, and, no, we'll shoot on digital so we can do twice as many takes. But time and again, Darius, I think, just chose the option that would be the high wire act, that would focus everyone's minds. And I think that has an effect, you know, an undeniable effect on on what people bring to the table.
Riz, I have to ask you, we were talking earlier about the different perspectives and how sound builds different perspectives, which means they recorded different types of sound. My understanding is, we keep talking about your body, we keep talking about your perspective. My understanding is that your body became a big part of the recording process, that they would do some takes, but then there would be about getting sound through your body to a certain degree on set, right?
It was kind of bizarre and amazing. It was like something from the future. I feel like Nicolas Becker is a time traveler or something, because what would normally happen on a film set is you finish a scene, sound recordist comes up with their boom and says, "Let's do a wild track," which means you do all the dialogue again, just for audio in case there was a helicopter flying over at that time, or, you know, there was some disturbance on one of the lines. Nicolas would come up to me with some kind of hexagonal orb that felt like it had been 3D printed in his like steampunk workshop, and would place it against my chest and whisper, "Now blink." And, "Excuse me?" "Okay, so I'll blink." And then he'd say, "Now breathe. Inhale, exhale. Now hold your breath so I can hear your heartbeat. Now swallow. Now lick the inside of your teeth with your tongue. Now swallow again." And correct me if I'm wrong, Darius, but a large part of the sound design from the film was built out of that inner subjective experience of Ruben's auditory world, which is very authentic, because sometimes when people lose their hearing, what they maintain some of is a kind of vibrational hearing, an auditory experience that comes through the body and the body's internal processes. So it was very much, again, as Darius said, like placing the audience into this first person, highly subjective experience to create sound design from really what it feels like to be inside my body.
That should be the selling point of the movie. We haven't really exploited that enough. You know what I mean, Riz? Like, wanna be inside Riz Ahmed's body?
Inside Riz.
Of metal. Inside Riz. Literally.
That's the tagline, I thought.
You did have a mic in your throat at one point. Is that not true? Is that not true, Riz? That there was a small mic that went down the throat?
Yeah, they have microphones everywhere, man. You don't even know. You don't even know.
You know, Darius, and we got to wrap up, but, you know, that we were talking about, you know, picture following sound in the beginning. Often there's not religiously, but there's like, if we're a little bit wider, we might hear the hearing world. If we're a little bit, you know, it's a more subjective shot, we might be more that internal Riz sound. And that pattern breaks down a little bit, but that's a little bit how we kind of get grounded with it. But I'm wondering, though, as we talk about these different layers of sounds and these different worlds, I'm wondering if you could talk about the edit, because not only was sound, I think, dictating camera, but I have to imagine that how you are choosing to go back and forth and when to enter this immersive kind of Riz sound world and when not, is that's not something that sound can lay over. It's like sound's got to inform the cut too, right?
It was immensely complicated, actually. And I actually called like a camp before we shot in Paris with Nicolas and with Daniel Bouquet for us to discuss this relationship before shooting around sound and picture, which is extremely rare to be thinking that way. But the reason is because, of course, like you say, they inform each other. And this was really tricky because you could easily get this wrong, which is to say you lose a sense of naturalism and the beauty by geeking out too much on how you cut in and out of perspective. And it was a really tricky balance. And we made very distinct choices with distinct lenses around what is perspective, what isn't, what is omniscient, what isn't. And we came to some kinds of rules about it early. And then, and it was an ongoing and really incredibly complex conversation, truly. And I think the film hopefully presents as being simple, because that's what I like and I'm drawn to. I don't want you to be thinking about the camera. I don't want you to be thinking necessarily about the sound. I just want you to be in it. But that's what made it so hard, because I was very aware of how we were going to be switching in and out, and I knew it had to happen on the cut. So I have this amazing editor, Mikkel, and Mikkel is just like shockingly good. He's an extraordinary storyteller, but he also is he's also immensely important to the sound design. So he and I worked on this a lot. And then while we were cutting picture, I would actually travel and work with Nicolas with the whole movie. And I could work on scenes and sound design simultaneously, which is unusual. And it had to happen because finding that balance was tricky. You know, you could really overplay your hand with this card, with this film, and finding that balance took experimentation. And but it had to be intentional before we started shooting. It wasn't something you could just do after.
Mm-hmm. I have to imagine, Riz, the choices that you made. There is no set rule, because obviously you can. After a while, it could become a gimmick if you keep cutting every time to a certain shot. Where, you know, I have to imagine Riz watching the movie finally put together and seeing all these choices and considering how much this is about the immersive experience that your character is going through. It must have been interesting to see how that shift of perspective ended up being finally decided on in the cut and the sound design, right?
Yeah, it was. You know, I think Darius kind of explained to me a little bit on set, like, listen, at this point, we're going to be hearing what you're hearing, which is, you know, I was really excited to kind of check it out and see how that would all work. But I have to say, I mean, like Darius said, it's deceptively simple. You know, it doesn't make a fuss over itself. I know what went into making that sound design and mm-hmm. how crazy it was that they created a whole language. That I think the sound mix was like half a year they took over this, and yet when you watch it as an audience member, you're not there going like, wow, look at these like zapping lasers and like crazy like Dolby bass that's rumbling unnecessarily. It just feels very naturally and simply like, oh, that's exactly what he'd be hearing. And so there was something just so surprisingly elegant, not simplistic, but simple and distilled in how they'd taken all these complex elements and created the sound design and just made it feel like something that, yeah, as Darius said, like just felt so natural, that, yeah, it's something that I think really enhances the viewing experience. And from what I understand, I'm not sure much like this has really been attempted before. In sound design, it does feel like a slightly groundbreaking thing that Nicolas and Darius and team have kind of embarked on. You know, we talk about virtual reality and first person kind of shooters and stuff, and I think this is a kind of a first person cinema that's quite exciting.
It is.
It's interesting when people talk a lot about, like, they refer to movies or this is an independent film, or they say this is a small film, and sometimes I find myself thinking, what is small? Like, what is your definition of small? Because, you know, when I think about Riz, your process, there's nothing small about that. You know, we are judging this by, like, what? Is it a $200 million film versus not? But the fact is that, yeah, that this sound design, I don't think there's been, you know, it's as big as it gets, you know, and those, these aspects of this movie are huge, even though the, that it's a personal movie, you know, and I think that's what people are talking about.
Well, congratulations to you both. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. And really, I was telling Riz before you came on, Darius. Riz is the first actor who's been on this podcast about craft and process. And I think it really has something to do with the fact that to understand what you guys did here, I think there's something in how it works, all of this stuff, the sound and the picture and the performance. And the way that you created this environment, I think it was.
Riz was a partner in process. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know that. Well, it's nice to talk to you again, Chris.
All right. Well, take care.
Thank you, guys. Much love. See ya.
See you, brother Riz.
Chris.
Bye, Darius. Bye.